feeling 100,000 million cowbirds having it to see and listen to remember and accept. I vow to taste the truth of the left tongue of his words.
Good morning. And especially good morning to you all. Thanks for joining us. That last chant, by the way, we do that chant, and it says the Tathagata's words. The Tathagata is just another word for the Buddha. So I'm going to say a little bit about the Buddha. But I want to just say how pleased I am that you guys kind of took this on to do this. And I was reflecting that, you know, if you could just have a national day where everybody one day a year went to visit a church, somebody else's church, just think what a better world that would be, you know, if Muslims would go visit and go to a Jewish synagogue, or people in Jewish synagogue would go and sit and take in a Muslim service. And just, if you did that, just think throughout the ages how much suffering would really have been eliminated. So this is a great thing. You're doing, maybe you're going to start something, you know? Maybe we could, people would just do that. So one thing I did want to say, though, because you, some of you probably don't know anything about Buddhism, is that Buddhism is, in a sense, like Christianity. There are lots of different flavors of Buddhism. And it'd be like Christianity, you know, where you have Catholics and Lutherans and Methodists and Episcopalians. And each one has a little bit of different flavor, but they all believe in the teachings of Christ. Well, that's true with Buddhists also. As Buddhism started in India, but as it moved up into China and Japan and North Korea and then down south into Burma and Thailand, the culture of each of those countries flavored it. And it's a little bit different in each place. And not every form of Buddhism practices meditation, for example. Probably most Buddhists in the world actually don't practice meditation, even though Buddha himself, it was a central part of his practice, which I'm going to talk about a little bit. So I thought, well, what would be interesting to you? And you know, I thought, well, when you walked in, there may be a couple questions. One would be, who is Buddha? Who was Buddha? And why in the heck do we sit on the floor? You know. So maybe I could answer both those. So about 500 years, 450 years before Christ was a very important time. There were people asking some really important questions all over the world, not just in Greece, northern Iran, in China. Many people were asking deep questions about religion. Like, who is God? How do we relate to God? Who are we? These kinds of deep questions. And Buddha was one of these people. He was actually a prince. His father had a small little kingdom in what is now southern Nepal. And he led a very sheltered life. But at one point, when he was in his early 20s, he went out and he observed that things were not the same outside as they were inside the shelter of the where he lived. He noticed that there was old age, sickness, and death. And it shocked him. It really shocked him. And he said, I want to try to understand this. Some of these things are going to happen to me. I want to try to understand this. So he started studying with a lot of teachers that existed during that time. There were many people that were interested in the same question. And they taught him meditation. He did not come up with meditation. They taught him meditation. And the form then, that many, you know, thousands of years ago, 2,500 years ago, is very similar now. If you were to go to Thailand or Burma, you would see monks living very much like Buddha did. Very simply, they wear a robe and have a little bowl, which they go into the village and the villagers feed them. And they meditate. And one of the ways they meditated, they found, was sitting on the floor because it was a little hard to carry probably a chair around. And they moved from village to village. And, you know, really, quite frankly, in India, you know, most people lived on the floor. They didn't really have chairs. But they also found that there was something about this way of sitting that was very solid, very much like on the ground, grounded. And that if they sat for long periods of time, which is what you do in meditation, that this was a very stable position. But if you come to meditation a little later in life and your legs aren't flexible, it's better to sit in a chair because it's a little too much discomfort. But they found that for long periods this seemed to work. You know, they'd get a bunch of little grass and then they'd put a little cloth over it and then they'd sit on it. And so this is what Buddha did. He said, okay, I want to try to find out the answers to these big questions. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to just sit down and I am going to study myself. I'm going to study myself. How does my mind really work? And he came to some very profound conclusions, which really, even though you're not a Buddhist, you will have come. You already know some of these conclusions that he came to. One thing he noticed when he sat down and watched his mind very carefully for many years was that there were some thoughts that made him happy and there were some thoughts that made him sad. He just noticed that. When I start to think, you know, I don't like that person, that makes me angry, I want this, but I can't get it. He noticed that those kinds of thoughts were not conducive to his happiness. And he noticed that when he had other thoughts, which were, I really want to take care of those people, I want to take care of myself, I have this feeling of affection for other people, he noticed that those thoughts actually made him happy. So he started practicing those thoughts that made him happy and being careful not to cultivate those thoughts that didn't. He also noticed that when he didn't have any thoughts or very few thoughts, that he was more present with his life. So he started training his mind to be more present with his life, whatever his life presented it, he was more engaged with it. And that was a very profound a discipline that he learned, that he started to teach his monks. In fact, that's what we learn in meditation. And you've probably noticed that yourself. You're walking down the street and your mind is very wrapped up in yourself. I like this. I don't like that. This person said this to me. I didn't like what they said to me. What can I say back to them? And as you're having this internal conversation in your head, you probably have noticed that you're not aware that the sun is very beautiful and bright and that the leaves have a beautiful color on them in the fall. You're just not very connected with what's happening. So the more you can train your mind to be present, to not follow those thoughts, or to learn to drop those thoughts, the more present you are with your life. It's pretty simple, actually, but pretty hard to do. Pretty hard discipline to do. He also noticed that pain wasn't optional in life. That we, you know, we fall, we scrape our knees, we get stomach aches. All these things happen. We have friends that get sick. We have family members that get sick. This is pain. This comes with life. There's not much you can do about that. But what you can do is how your mind reacts to the pain. You have a lot of control over how you think about the pain. So pain is not really optional in life. But suffering is optional. Suffering is the mental reaction to the pain. So he began to notice this. This was really important. He also noticed that all his thoughts were very temporary. They came and they went. And so any thought he had about himself was going to change. And somehow this was very liberating for him, because he didn't get so self-centered or so fixated on himself. So I thought it'd be nice if I just read you. This is a modern Zen teacher in Japan who I know, named Harada Roshi. And he's quoting a Chinese teacher that existed in about 800 AD. About 800 AD. He's quoting this. And the story is that this is a teacher, like a minister, who's head of a monastery. He's a pretty famous teacher. And he's gone out wandering, and nobody knows where he is, and he comes back, and one of the other teachers says to him, you know, where have you been? There's a lot of people here that are waiting to see you, and they want you to teach them about Zen, and where have you been? And so he says to them, his name was Chosha. And Chosha responded, he says, you know, I went to the mountains to play a little. The cherry and peach flowers were so beautiful. And while I was looking at them, they pulled me right into the deep mountains. And then the clover and the dandelions were blooming and the butterflies were dancing. And while looking at them, I arrived home again. That was his quote. That was his response. And so this teacher, this contemporary teacher, is actually talking. He says, he was saying that the meaning of life is found in the encounters of each and every moment. Although we need to have goals, if we aren't acting playfully within each and every second of realizing our goals, if we think while in the midst of living and struggling that we have to wait and later to play, then we aren't realizing the true value of life. And so people who go to school or work from Monday to Friday often think they have to wait until the weekends to be happy. After 5 days of working hard, then we try to make up for it on the 2 days of being happy. But what kind of life is this? This kind of the concentration or being present with your life isn't about waiting for the future, but about finding joy no matter where we are. No matter how difficult or miserable our circumstances, it is about living wholly and truthfully in each moment. So that's really the essence, in some ways, what meditation has to teach, and particularly what Zen has to teach. And in some ways, Zen, even with Zen, the word Zen, which is our particular kind of Buddhism, what it means is meditation. It's a Chinese word meaning meditation. And Buddha was actually was a little suspicious of probably even calling himself a Buddha. Because if he called himself a Buddha and you call yourself a Methodist, already we're a little bit separate, right? I'm a Buddhist, you're a Methodist, you're a Jew. So already we think there's a difference. But really, I think what all religions are trying to say at some deep place is that there's more that we're similar than we're dissimilar. And last week I went to, there was a fundraiser in the hall right behind you from a group in Annalee called Global Student Exchange. And this is a bunch of kids in Annalee. Anybody know about this? Global Student Exchange? This is a great thing. What they did was they said, you know, this would be a wonderful thing if we just go visit another country. And since I was in the Peace Corps many years ago and lived a couple of years in Africa, I found that this is true. If you're in your head and you're just thinking about somebody else, how different they are, because they are pretty different. But if you go there, you find that actually they have the same interests you do. They want to be happy. They're really concerned about their kids. They want to have enough food. They want to feel safe. And when you're living with people and you connect at that level, there's a certain caring. And we can call that caring love, and we can call it compassion. And I think that if, you know, Buddha and Christ were to meet, they would be very good friends. I'm very absolutely convinced of that. That they would totally see the world in very, very similar ways. That what's really important is for us to not be so self-concerned and to be able to reach out with a sense of love and compassion for other people. So I wanted to say before, I just want to give you a little bit of meditation practice. That so one of our practices, our main practice, is that we sit. We just sit and we try to be present. We try to let a lot of these self-centered thoughts go, and so we're just really present, you know, with our body, our feelings, the wind, the air, the sky. But we do have other practices, and one of the little phrases that we've been practicing with during this time of year, which I thought would be nice for Thanksgiving, since we're moving up on Thanksgiving, there was a Tibetan teacher, and he had a list of about 56 little phrases or slogans that we've been studying. And one of the slogans is, it says, to reflect on the kindness of others. So I thought that I'd give encourage you all to take that up, but also everybody here in my group this next week to take up the slogan. Reflect on the kindness of others. Reflect, and another translation of that is reflect on the benefit of others. The benefit of others. So as you go through this week, think that actually everything that you touch and use, how much effort that people have put into it to bring it to you. Whether it's your food, particularly when you eat, the farmers, the people that bring you the food, the people that sell you the food. That's just one thing. But it could be anything. It could be this piece of paper. The benefit of everybody that brought us this piece of paper. The people that had to go in and cut the trees down, and people that had to make the paper, and then people that had to, you know, make the ink that I could print on this paper. All of this is of a benefit to you. And actually, anything that you touch, the whole world is connected with this, being to bring this to us. But it also means that even those things that you don't think are a benefit, for example, what this particular teacher, Tisha, says, even if you have people that say disagree with you or maybe say unkind things about you, even those people, and those happen to all of us, even those people are a benefit. And how could they be a benefit? Because how else are you going to learn compassion and patience for other people unless you have people challenge your sense of patience? So even those people, you know, even the people that honk their horn behind you when you're in your car, even those people are a benefit because you get to practice patience and calmness because of their actions. So maybe this week we can reflect on the kindness and the benefit of everything. Just occasionally, just pick anything up and just reflect on how supportive that is. So maybe that's a good place for me to end right now, just to talk before I talk about Buddhism. But I wanted to give you a chance. Do you have any questions at all about Buddhism? You got it figured out pretty well?
Good. I have a question. Yeah. So yeah. I'm not familiar with the different flavors. So
yeah.
Zen, what's kind of particular about Zen as opposed to...
Well, that's a good question. I actually had that in here, but I didn't want to get into it too much. So the particular flavor of Zen is that initially what Buddha really said was, we think, you know, was... Well, first of all, people didn't read, right? Most people didn't read. The printed word wasn't out. So he said, well, let's just study. Let's sit down and meditate and let's try to study ourselves directly. So maybe you could say we put more emphasis on direct experience of disciplining and watching ourselves in our mind than we do, say, maybe reading or studying about it. It'd be a little like if you studied about basketball and read about it in a book. That's very different than if you played it. So what we would say in Zen is, let's play it. Let's really engage with it. That's one thing. The other thing is that we tend to be very mindful in activities. Like if we're washing the dishes, for example. We don't see meditation or prayer. You could say meditation is like prayer, is the main way we do it. But then when we wash our dishes or we drive our car or we're walking down the street, that's different. We try to bring a sense of mindfulness, attentiveness to each activity that we do with a sense of gratitude. Like, oh, wow, a piece of paper. How wonderful. So maybe that's a little bit of a flavor. And we do like nature a lot because Zen actually incorporated a lot of Taoism in China, and the Taoist teachings were very connected with kind of nature teaching. So that's a little bit. Any other? Anybody else have any questions? So I thought maybe I'd give you, I asked outside, I said, do you think you can sit for 5 minutes? And everyone was kind of blank except one guy went, no. So I like that, a real honest approach there. But you can do it. And that's what's neat about doing it with everybody, because you support each other. Really, it's a lot easier to do it with a bunch of people. So we're going to sit for 5 minutes, okay? I'm going to give you two kinds of meditation. Basic meditation practice. It sounds so simple. Is you're going to, first of all, you need to sit up straight. And your back needs to be straight. It's not about falling asleep, because you're really going to watch your mind. Now, you can close your eyes if you'd like. In the Zen tradition, we tend to keep the eyes open a little bit. Not really wide open, but open a little bit, because we're wanting this sense of concentration to also be out into our normal life, not this is the only place we do. So kind of just put some energy in your back, raise your chest up a little bit, drop your chin down, put your tongue behind your upper teeth. Your hands can be on your knees, or they can be, in the Zen tradition, often we cup them, left hand on top of the right. And now bring your attention to your tummy. Make your stomach nice and soft. And now feel the breath. You're going to concentrate on your breath. You need something to concentrate on. We're going to concentrate on the breath. And as you breathe in, feel your stomach expand. And then you breathe out, feel your stomach relax and fall. Expand and fall. So you're anchoring on that sensation in your stomach. Rising, falling. Now, what's helpful in beginning meditation, but also anytime, is just to count your breaths. Because if you count the breaths, it'll slow the mind down. So let's just do that for a couple rounds. Breathe in, feel the stomach nice and soft. And exhale, then you count one. Inhale. Count two. See if you can count up to five. And then turn around and count up to five again. You have to concentrate. You're training your mind right now to be concentrated in the present moment. And you can be any religion. You know, this meditation practice isn't just Buddhist. Anybody can do this. Any religion can do this. Now, you can just stay with five, but let's make it a little harder. Let's see if you can count to 10. Feel the inhale, feel the exhale, and count. Now, if you do this for a while, you'll notice that you'll lose track of your counting. When you do that, just start over again at one. Most people can count to 10 maybe once, twice. Then you start to lose it a little bit. But the more you meditate, the more your concentration will become stronger. Now what will happen is thoughts will start to come to your mind. The instruction is let thoughts come, but then drop them. Drop your thoughts. As soon as you're aware of your thoughts, drop them. And return to feeling your breath at your stomach. And counting. So in this way, you train your mind to be very present in the moment. You may notice also you can hear the air conditioning in the room. You can feel the air against your skin. Don't let your thoughts carry you away. Keep coming back to your immediate sensation. So it takes discipline and effort and concentration. I'm going to give you one more meditation. This is going to help you. You can use a phrase to calm your mind down. So try this phrase. On your in-breath, say, may I be. And on your out-breath, say, peaceful and at ease. May I be peaceful and at ease. And feel your body and your mind become more peaceful and ease. Just feel it relax. May I be peaceful and at ease. And you just say the phrase, and that will calm your mind down, and it will calm your body down. And then you can say, if you'd like, may everybody in this room be peaceful and at ease, and wish that for them. May they be peaceful and at ease. May I be peaceful and at ease. May my grandmother be peaceful and at ease. May I be peaceful and at ease. Okay. Well, I cheated. You did it for 8 minutes. That wasn't too bad, was it? So you can start 5 minutes. And like I said, anybody in any religion can do this, and it's just a helpful thing to do. You just are practicing calming the mind and being present. And how could that not be healthy for you, right? And if you do this for other people, and you wish that they were peaceful entities, it opens your heart up. So, pretty simple practice, but actually hard to discipline yourself to do. Right? But we try. We try to do it. That's kind of like our prayer. You know, one way to think about this as prayer is we're just opening ourselves up to the universe, right? Which is what prayer really is. You're just opening up. Okay, universe, talk to me. Yeah, anybody have any questions? Yeah.
Bruce, maybe you could speak on whether Buddha is God.
Say that again?
Oh. Is Buddha God?
Oh, is Buddha God?
Or a God.
Is Buddha a God? Well, again, there's lots of different types of Buddhism. Like, you all know about the church south of town, you know that the Buddhist church there, which was started many years ago, right? So they're a Pure Land church, and if you were to ask them, is Buddha a God, they may actually say, yeah, we actually believe there's a Buddha, a person Buddha, like this fellow named Shakyamuni Buddha, who was a real person. But he says, we believe there's a Buddha as more. It's kind of like, very much like a Christian God. We would believe that. But in Zen, we don't. We would say more that, we would say Buddha was maybe a reflection. What Buddha understood was that everything is supportive in the universe. Everything supports us, even things we don't particularly like. And in that respect, because he understood that, his consciousness was very, very broad and expansive. We wouldn't call him a god. In Zen, we wouldn't call him a god. We'd call him a very profound teacher, just like we would say Christ was an incredibly profound teacher. We would say probably Buddha isn't any different. Buddhists would say that. It wasn't any different from Christ in the sense that they both understood how we're all connected. That we would say God is more like the oneness of everything. Would be as close as we'd say. The oneness of everything. That's my definition today. I may come up with a different one tomorrow, but that would be the way I'd say it. There are certain people that can just make people see the oneness of everything. And we would say that Christ and Buddha both had that ability. So we need to treat other people very well because they're not really different than us. Any other questions? Good. Okay. So, you don't actually have to sit either to meditate, you know, when you're walking. You can do that when you're walking. Instead of losing yourself, you know, into all your problems, just try to be without... Wow, the rain's falling. Amazing. Ooh, look, seagulls are flying over that. So you're very connected. Just like that master, you know, many, many years ago, went out in the mountains and just was very present with everything that was there. Okay. So, Thanksgiving is coming up. So let's all practice with reflect on the kindness and benefit of others. But that means everything, not just people. You know, not just people we don't necessarily like that much. We got to, you know, reflect on the benefit they give us. And reflect on Uncle Charlie, who is going to be at the table and who maybe you'd rather not be having dinner with, but there's a benefit there. What's the benefit? What's all the benefit? And the turkey, the benefit of the turkey and the food and everything that supports our life. And we'll talk about that next week. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for being so gracious in receiving us.
Well, my pleasure. Got me to, you know, I get to think about things in a kind of a beginner way, which is nice. That's important. Okay. We have a little chant that we do at the end.
May our intentions deeply penetrate every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Have a wonderful. Thanks, Kate.